Peter B. Collins News and Comment for Monday, August 18th, 2014. The summer riots continue in Ferguson, Missouri. I think Americans' denial about racial tensions, about class divisions, and about the creeping police state in this country are all being confronted in the streets outside St. Louis in Ferguson, Missouri. And last night I watched with a real sense of angst as protesters reportedly fired shots and Molotov cocktails in the direction of police officers, and they said they were peacefully marching to the command post at the Target store because they wanted to talk to the cops. The reaction? Well, those armored personnel carriers that we thought were wonderful when they were preventing our troops from getting killed in Iraq and Afghanistan have now been deployed to the mean streets of America. And I'm not patting myself on the back here, and I hope this doesn't annoy you, but I have been talking about this for years now. Very concerned about the creep of militarism, the vertical integration of local law enforcement with the FBI and the Justice Department's fusion centers, joint terrorism task forces, the huge amount of money that the Homeland Security Department has showered on local police agencies. And this is now being brought to the high-definition flat TV screens of every American. And I'm sorry that that's what it takes. And we'll find out sooner or later if Michael Brown was an innocent victim of police overreaction. I have to say the story is mixed, but I'm suspicious of both sides. We saw Friday when the white police chief of Ferguson finally revealed the name of the cop who killed Michael Brown. But in the same breath, they released the convenience store video. Pretty clearly shows Michael Brown stealing these little cigars that are used to make blunts, roughing up an ethnic, apparently Indian or Pakistani, storekeeper. Now, that in no way justifies his killing. But then the family, late on Sunday, as the violence was erupting on the streets of Ferguson, reported out their own autopsy of Michael Brown, which was immediately published by the New York Times. Now, it changes the story a little bit, because we were told that the unarmed Michael Brown was walking away from the police officer when he opened fire. And there's six, possibly eight shots that were fired into Michael Brown's body. Reportedly, two were to the top of his head, and the remainder to his arms and torso. But the report is that all the bullets were to his front. And was he standing there with his hands up? Is that why his arms took bullets? Or was he charging at this police officer? Well, we don't know. And I'm not going to play Nancy Grace. I refuse to do this in the Trayvon Martin case. So many people saw one piece of video or another, and they reached their own conclusions. I think it's never that simple. But what is simple to me is that the heavy-handed reaction of state authorities, who are universally seen as the white man, against this predominantly African-American community have been really badly handled. The latest is today that Governor Jay Nixon has lifted the curfew after deploying the Missouri National Guard to the streets of Ferguson, where they've imposed a ban on standing around. You can walk up and down the street, but you cannot form a crowd and just stand there. Now, this is de facto martial law. And I find it twisted funny that the headline here from the New York Times reads, Governor lifts curfew after deploying National Guard. Well, I believe that this is worse than just a curfew, because the Guard is there 24 hours a day. And last night, as I mentioned, I flipped on CNN hoping to get some live coverage, and at first it was this new John Walsh show. I watched it for a few minutes, and it was about what it takes to cross the border, and actually the only offensive part was John Walsh's commentary. The rest of it was kind of interesting and offered, an explanation of how some of these women and children have reached our border in the last year or so. But then they cut off John Walsh and went live with a really rookie anchor. I didn't get her last name, but they were calling her Poppy. And she kept repeating the same stuff over and over again. It was really annoying. And what's interesting is that CNN didn't have an anchor, an Anderson Cooper or a Wolf Blitzer, anyone of real experience who was willing to come in on a Sunday night in August. I guess they're all hobnobbing with Obama in Martha's Vineyard. And then in the streets of Ferguson, they had two very capable producers who went on camera, which suggests that they didn't have any reporters there. And I think just this shows that the corporate media was just looking for pictures. That's what producers gather. Not for any kind of in-depth reporting or detailed coverage. And this woman, Poppy, mischaracterized comments from one of these CNN producers, and she started injecting into her recap of the narrative that shots had been fired at police officers. Now, that does appear to be true. But the two producers who work for CNN, who she repeatedly questioned about this, said, no, we don't have any evidence that people in the crowd fired shots at cops. We heard shots fired, but it's possible they were shooting at each other. And so it's understandable in a chaotic situation. But CNN's coverage was really amateurish, starting with the anchor who was presenting that, I think from Atlanta, but I'm not really sure where she was located. So, again, I refuse to make a snap judgment here on exactly whether the cop abused his power, whether because Michael Brown was feeling that he was a fugitive having just lifted, you can say robbed, he had robbed the store of $50 worth of these little cigars, that maybe he overreacted to the stop from the cop. And of course, what the hell was he doing walking down the middle of the street in broad daylight? That's why the cop stopped him to begin with. So now also from the autopsy, what has dribbled out is that there was marijuana in Michael Brown's system. Again, this is kind of selective release of information designed to shape our view of the victim in this case. And of course, marijuana stays in the system for a week, sometimes longer. And I'm curious because typically, you know, when these events occur, we're told, well, 4 to 6 weeks from now, we'll have a toxicology report for you. But 8 days after the incident, again, selectively released that Michael Brown had cannabis in his system. I want to share with you two very different but interesting posts from Facebook. First, from Scott Crow, who's been a guest on our program. He's an anarchist based in Austin, Texas, and a very bright man. And he attributes the information I'm about to cite to an activist in Seattle, a man named Stella Banda. Police in the United States have killed 5,000 unarmed people domestically since September 11, 2001. About the same number of U.S. soldiers killed by resistance movements in Iraq during that period. The vast majority of those killed have been people of color, and of those who were white, nearly all were poor, disabled, or otherwise marginalized. On average, an officer shoots an unarmed black person in the United States once every 28 hours. A rate of murder higher than that committed by the KKK during the height of their activity. Police officers have the highest rates of domestic abuse by profession, and women battered by cops have almost no recourse to end their abuse since police unions, prosecutors, and other law enforcement will rarely break ranks with another cop. It's an open secret that police evidence rooms leak thousands of pounds of drugs every year. That to meet quotas, police and arrest plant those drugs on innocent people. And then Eric Dreitzer, who I know through the team at Boiling Frogs Post, put up this satirical, now put your tongue in cheek as you listen to this, this little post on Facebook. Activists say that police in Ferguson are gearing up to slaughter protesters en masse. Obviously, this is an imminent massacre that must be stopped. We hereby call for an international force of nations to militarily intervene to stop this imminent genocide, as the regime in Washington has lost its mandate and its legitimacy. We call for the United Nations to step up and pass a resolution calling on the American regime to withdraw its forces. We call on Russia, China, Venezuela, North Korea, and all others in the international community to uphold the values of civilized society by bombing Missouri. Now, yes, that's deep satire. But it's an interesting role reversal. As the United States preaches all these things to other people, and then we bomb. And to its credit, the New York Times is exposing the militarization of our local police agencies. Front page Saturday, a graphic showing that Richland County, South Carolina, has an M113 armored personnel carrier. In Stevens County, Oklahoma, they got a surplus Huey helicopter from the Pentagon. San Bernardino has a Beechcraft C-12. There's another copter in New Hanover County, North Carolina. Grenade launchers. Another helicopter. Mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle. That's what we've seen being used in Ferguson. Armored vehicle. M16s, we saw those brandished and aimed at humans. And in the Sunday Times, no, I take that back, it's inside the Saturday paper, they go on with maps that show the distribution of military surplus gear. And when you look at the map, for example, on assault rifles, there are very few parts of the country that don't have very dense markings representing large numbers of these weapons. Night vision goggles, armored vehicles, body armor, aircraft, grenade launchers. Yeah, that's what your local police department has these days, not just a billy club and a two-way radio. I'm glad, despite the circumstances, that Americans are finally getting a glimpse of what has been developing quietly over the last few years. And I want to give a shout-out to Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri Highway Patrol. He's got the toughest job in America these days because he is trying to mediate between the white leadership, including Governor Jay Nixon and the white mayor and white police chief in Ferguson, and a very angry, and I think legitimately angry, group of people. It's been simmering for a long, long time. There's no question about it. And it takes real balls for an African-American like Ron Johnson to risk being called an Uncle Ron or an Uncle Tom. And I watched this chaotic community meeting with a press conference element to it on Saturday on live television. And Governor Nixon was at the podium with Captain Johnson. But Johnson was clearly in charge and calling the shots. And the governor was, he didn't appear nervous. but he was certainly being peppered with a lot of unpleasant commentary, and mostly he chose to say nothing and let this black man be his human shield. And I imagine that there are 100 different opinions of Ron Johnson, particularly on the streets of Ferguson. But he's a guy who's really put himself on the line, and I think that is worth acknowledging. We like to every day acknowledge the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. I was a little bummed out when I got the first notice from PayPal over the weekend that Gary Batterson, a longtime subscriber, had canceled his $10 a month subscription. I didn't panic. I didn't freak. A few minutes later, I got another notice from PayPal that Gary Batterson had just taken out a new subscription, doubling his monthly contribution to the maximum of $20. Gary, that really touches me, and I appreciate it. Paul Elsesser is one of our longest subscribers who supports us at the same level every month, and I really appreciate that, gentlemen. I'd like others to join in. I need your help to keep this podcast sustaining, going, and cover the bills here. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the link under my picture that says sign up. It takes you to a page where you choose $10, $20, or even $5 a month. There's even a $1 24-hour pass if something strikes you that you've just got to listen to right away. Of course, the best deal is our $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers in the U.S. get a free copy of a music CD called Red Flag by our friend John Dist. Well, I am still very confused about the crisis facing the Yazidis in northwestern Iraq. And as you know, on Friday, if you listened, I kind of reached the point of saying, wow, was this all just exaggerated and hyped up for American media consumption as a diversion and a pretext for Obama to conduct indefinite bombing raids against the Islamic State, these Sunni radicals? But then the news broke that on Friday, the fighters of IS went into a town, a village, and reportedly gave its residents a deadline to convert to Islam. And those who did not were slaughtered. Now, the unconfirmed report is that at least 80 people died. On television, I saw that number drift up to 300. It's also reported that women and children were rounded up and taken hostage. And so I am frankly conflicted and confused, because we were told all the Yazidis ran up on Mount Sinjar, and that most of them have been rescued by Syrian Kurd fighters. And so I will wait to get a clearer picture of this. But I have to say that, again, the corporate media isn't doing its job here to bring us the facts. They're relying on official government sources to tell us what's going on in one of the most important flashpoints that we face. A remarkably frank commentary was published in Sunday's New York Times in the op-ed section, and it was written by Ali Kedari. And he served as a special assistant to five American ambassadors in Iraq and as a senior advisor to three heads of the Central Command from 2003 to 2010. So while you might consider him to be some sort of a toady of the United States, he certainly has a lot of experience in Iraq since the U.S. invasion and occupation. And he says, I was involved in the formation of all five of Iraq's governments between 2003 and 2010. And then he lapses into some honesty here that I think is stunning and refreshing. He said, after spending more than $1 trillion and losing some 4,500 soldiers, American politicians cannot dare reveal a dirty little secret. Since 2003, Iraq has developed into a combination of Lebanon and Nigeria, a toxic brew of sectarian politics and oil-fueled kleptocracy. The combination of religious rivalry and endemic corruption has hollowed out the Iraqi government, as evidenced by the country's ongoing electricity crisis and the collapse of the entire Iraqi army divisions in the face of an advance of the ISIS forces into Mosul. And he goes on to say that Maliki's successor, Abadi, has inherited a country on the verge of collapse. Whether Iraq will shatter or be salvaged is not in his hands alone. It will depend on a dizzying number of other leaders, political parties, non-state actors, and neighboring and global powers. And one of the fantasies people have that I think are often projected by Washington is that a unity government, let's say Abadi is Superman, and that he can unify Iraq. Well, there's been so much damage under the Shiite Maliki government that I think that idea is, well, frankly, well past its prime. And he writes, the secular Sunnis and Shiites who are sympathetic to Hussein's Ba'ath Party rule, Ba'ath Party rule, view Dawah, that's the party of Abadi and Maliki, as puppets of Iran. Likewise, they see Sunni Islamist parties like Speaker Salim al-Jaburi's Iraq Islamic Party as mere extensions of the fanatical Muslim Brotherhood. The Islamists see the secularists as drinking, smoking, whoring agents of Western intelligence services on an unholy crusade to separate mosque and state. Their visions of life, religion, and politics are fundamentally incompatible, and that's the heart of Iraqis' violent struggle to define themselves and their future. One more quote. He says, today's Iraqi security forces are almost exclusively Shiite, reinforced by militias, financed, trained, armed, and directed by Iran. So I think that the end game here is pretty clear. And that is that there will be three countries replacing the state of Iraq. It's just a matter of when and how much blood is shed to reach that point. Now to the flashpoint between Israel and Hamas, that would be Gaza. Today, the ceasefire is in the midst of expiring as I speak to you. It's 2:30 Pacific time, and at 2 o'clock our time is when the current five-day ceasefire was to expire. I've not heard of any extension. And Palestinians say Israel is stalling on negotiations. That does not surprise me. And one of the things that has occurred in the last day or so is that Israeli forces destroyed the West Bank homes of three men it accused of being behind the June kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers. Now, we've been covering this in some detail because there was an 18-day period after the teens were kidnapped and before the Israeli government announced that they had been killed. And during that time, I can still see Bibi Netanyahu pointing that index finger and saying, we know Hamas did this and Hamas will pay, Hamas will pay, Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. Well, their destruction of these three homes, which is hardly democratic, after all, there's been no, these individuals have not been arrested, they have not been charged or tried. The Israeli government, on its own knowledge and authority, has simply decided to blow up their homes. And there will be no criticism of that here in the democratic United States that calls Israel our only democracy, our only democratic ally in the region. But this is a clear admission that Hamas was not responsible. And we know that Israel intentionally escalated the tensions using the three kidnapped teenagers, like the Yazidis are being used to justify America's new involvement in Iraq. And yet, no one will call out the big lie. Here in California, Sunday afternoon, a group of protesters showed up at the Port of Oakland and successfully blocked the unloading of an Israeli ship called the Zim Piraeus. It was coming into port, and these activists, using the technology available to them, tracked the progress of the vehicle, got a couple of hundred protesters to block the gates, and the dock workers, members of the Longshore Workers Union, honored the picket line, and it was an interesting, what can we call it, a protest, an interesting symbolic stop. It's likely that that ship will be unloaded today. But on Tuesday, members of Code Pink for Peace have announced an action against the Oakland office of Senator Barbara Boxer, a longtime apologist for Israel. They've been requesting a meeting for 2 weeks to talk to even just a lowly staff member or an intern, and they can't even get access to the office building where Boxer has her local public office. Yeah, we pay for that office, but we're not allowed to visit it. And this interesting piece came across my email over the weekend from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And they cite a report to the U.S. Congress that I had not yet seen, that since 1962, American military aid to Israel has amounted to $100 billion. And, you know, I wouldn't feel bad about that money if it had been money that was used to promote peace. Most of that money has been used to kill Palestinians and to build the military arsenal that makes Israel the preeminent regional power. And if they use that power wisely, I might not feel regretful about it. But this surfaces in the context of a momentary glitch in the resupply of American weapons to Israel during the July confrontation, the assault on Gaza. And Israel was very concerned because Hellfire missiles and other munitions were held up at the Pentagon, apparently on orders of the White House. And the Haaretz story tries to put this into some context, saying, don't get your panties all twisted up. The weapons are flowing. The U.S. continues its relentless support of Israel. And I don't know how I'm so lucky, but I'm on an email list of John Bolton's Political Action Committee. You remember him, the guy with the real bushy mustache, and he was a national security advisor, one of the neocons in the Bush administration, and they made him ambassador to the UN in Bush's second term. He hates the UN. Everybody knows that. So he's running interference for Israel in this email, and he opens it. He said, as the former United States ambassador to the UN, my eyes have long been open to the dangerous biases and political agendas in play at the UN. So he is trying to defund any UN investigation into alleged Israeli war crimes in the current conflict. And he declares that any effort to investigate and to find a just result is blatant pro-Hamas propaganda, and that it is an anti-U.S. effort as well. And it's mainly a fundraising letter. He wants money for his political action committee so that he can help elect more right-wing nuts to the United States Congress. Hey, speaking of nuts, somewhere there's a village in Texas missing its idiot. And the news broke late Friday that Governor Rick Perry, with his new Superman Clark Kent glasses, has been indicted by a grand jury in Austin, Texas. And I won't bore you with the details. The accusation is he abused his power by threatening a veto in an effort to pressure a Democratic district attorney to resign because she had been convicted of drunk driving. Now, I don't know about her driving, but this prosecutor has been a real thorn in the side of Republicans in Texas because she's a Democrat. And so this is a partisan political squabble. We'll see how it all plays out. Meanwhile, in Montana over the weekend, to replace the plagiarist, temporary Senator John Walsh, on the ballot this November, Democratic rank and file selected Amanda Curtis. She is a school teacher. She grew up in poverty and tragedy, and she was recently elected to the lower house in the Montana legislature. And the one thing she is very skilled at is YouTube activism. I actually spent a little time watching a couple of her videos, and, you know, she knows how to use digital technology. But the odds are so much against her that she's pretty much been declared dead on arrival. She had to declare, "I'm not a sacrificial lamb." Well, my friends in Montana say that she's bright and progressive. And let's see if we can turn the odds over and get her elected. Over in Hawaii, it was the Big Island that determined the outcome of the Senate primary. As you may know, Senator Brian Schatz was appointed by Governor Neil Abercrombie, who got bounced by voters by a huge margin in the primary that was interrupted by a tropical storm, and that limited, Izell limited the voting on the Big Island of Hawaii. And that final tally took place on Saturday, I think. And the winner has been declared Brian Schatz by 1,600 votes. So the loser there is Colleen Hanabusa. And Russ Archibald and friends there in Kailua Kona, or just south of there, I'd love to get your input on whether this was an honest election and if you're happy with the outcome. And finally today, Julian Assange, after spending 2 years in the Embassy of Ecuador in London, said today that he will be leaving soon, but he provided no specifics. As you know, he is not indicted in the U.S. or Sweden, but he faces extradition to Sweden for questioning into allegations of sexual misconduct. Women who went to bed with him later complained that he refused to wear a condom, or, you know, that there was sex that they considered to be non-consensual. And so I can't really judge the validity of those charges. But some news agencies have reported that Assange will announce that he has to seek medical treatment, allegedly suffering from arrhythmia, very high blood pressure, and a chronic lung condition. But Assange said that he's decided to leave soon, but perhaps not for the reasons that the Murdoch press are saying at the moment. He did not elaborate or offer any other explanation. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're authorized to share this podcast with absolutely anyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.